Stopping Mass Killings in Africa. Introduction to Genocide. Dr. Douglas C. Pfeiffer. Never again. Two words capture the grim determination of Holocaust survivors that the world should never forget what happened and never allow another cold-blooded murder of millions based on their religion, ethnicity, race, or national origin. Following Raoul Heiberg's groundbreaking destruction of the European Jews in 1961 and the trial of Adolf Eichmann the same year, a dense network of scholars, university programs, foundations, and museums slowly developed to ensure that the Holocaust or Shoah would never be forgotten and to examine the causes and conditions that allowed it to happen. Parallel efforts emerged dedicated to the understanding of the Armenian Genocide, the destruction of Native Americans, and other mass killings. Yet despite these efforts, the international community stood by and allowed genocide to unfold in Cambodia and Bosnia and Rwanda and elsewhere during the closing decades of the 20th century. The 21st century has proved equally disturbing thus far, with perhaps as many as 400,000 lives extinguished in Darfur and some 2.3 million Darfurists displaced by the violence. Genocide Watch, an international group dedicated to raising awareness of and influencing public policies toward potential and actual genocides, lists one genocide in progress, Darfur, one region where genocide is deemed imminent, Chad, and four areas exhibiting warning signs of possible mass killing, Burma, Kenya, Uzbekistan, and Zimbabwe, as of January 2008. Outraged by the inaction of the nations and the international community to the killing fields of Cambodia, the Rwandan genocide of 1994, the slaughter of some 7,000 Bosnian Muslim men and boys at Srebrenica in July 1995, and the deteriorating situation in Kosovo in the late 1990s, concerned individuals and organizations began to network and become more active in generating pressure to prevent future genocides. The United States Holocaust Memorial Museum, USHMM, established a Committee on Conscience, charged with alerting the national conscience, influencing policymakers, and stimulating worldwide action to confront and halt genocide, mass killings, and related crimes against humanity. Samantha Power, a war correspondent, pricked Americans' conscience with her frontline article, The Balkans, during the 1990s, and a best-selling 2002 book, A Problem from Hell, America and the Age of Genocide. Gregory Stanton, an international human rights lawyer who worked for the U.S. Department of State Office of Cambodian Genocide Investigations, founded Genocide Watch. Existing non-governmental organizations such as Refugees International became increasingly concerned about the overlap between humanitarian assistance, war, and genocide. Last but not least, universities became ever more engaged in genocide studies, with institutes and centers such as the Montreal Institute for Genocide and Human Rights Studies and Yale University's Genocide Studies program generating both scholarship and activism. Not surprisingly, amongst the most vocal voices pressing the U.S. government and the United Nations for action were student groups such as Students Taking Action Now, Darfur, STAND, whose chapters have organized dozens of rallies, vigils, and teach-ins about Darfur since the first chapter was founded at Georgetown University in 2004. As journalists, citizens' coalitions, student action groups, university centers, and policy institutes generate public awareness of mass killing and genocides, American politicians responded. On the Republican side, President George W. Bush included genocide amongst the security challenges he addressed in his 2002 National Security Strategy and elevated the issue in his 2006 National Security Strategy, devoting an entire page to the issue. President Bush warned that it is a moral imperative that states take action to prevent and punish genocide. History teaches that sometimes other states will not act unless America does its part. We must refine United States government efforts, economic, diplomatic, and law enforcement, so that they target those individuals responsible for genocide and not the innocent citizens they rule. Where perpetrators of mass killing defy all attempts at peaceful intervention, armed intervention may be required. preferably by the forces of several nations working together under appropriate regional or international auspices. We must not allow the legal debate over the technical definition of genocide to excuse inaction. The world must act in the cases of mass atrocities and mass killings that will eventually lead to genocide, even if the local parties are not prepared for peace. President Bush was not the only voice in the Republican camp taking up the issue. Others, such as Senator Sam Brownback of Kansas and Representative Henry Hyde of Illinois, have been deeply engaged in seeking solutions for the Darfur crisis. On the Democratic side, Representatives Tom Lantos, California, and Michael Capuano, Maryland, has sponsored legislation on the issue, with Joseph Biden, Delaware, Richard Durbin, Illinois, Hillary Clinton, New York, and Joseph Lieberman, Connecticut, tackling the issue in the Senate. While activists have unhappily noted the mass killings continue in Darfur and threaten to unfold in southern Sudan, Somalia, and elsewhere, the president's appointment of a special envoy to Sudan, Andrew Natosis, September 2006, December 2007, and subsequently Richard Williamson, stands in stark contrast to the U.S. hands-off policy during the Rwandan genocide. Seeking to generate concrete, practical recommendations to enhance the U.S. government's capacity to respond to emerging threats of genocide and mass atrocities, former Secretary of State Madeleine Albright and former Secretary of Defense William Cohen announced in November 2007 the creation of a Genocide Prevention Task Force. Madeleine Albright's opening statement captures the problem the policymakers face when confronted with mass killings. The world agrees that genocide is unacceptable, and yet genocide and mass killings continue. Our challenge is to match words to deeds and stop allowing the unacceptable. That task, simple on the surface, is in fact one of the most persistent puzzles of our times. We have a duty to find the answer before the vow of never again. It's defining genocide. Raphael Lemkin first coined the term genocide in 1944 as he struggled to convey Nazi extermination policies in his book, Axis Rule in Occupied Europe. Born in what was the Polish portion of the Russian Empire, a young Lemkin had grown up under the shadow of pogrom and persecution as a Polish Jew. Graduating from Lwów Law School in the 1920s, he felt drawn to the topic of mass killings, studying the fate of the Armenians and the Assyrian minority in Iraq. Well before the contours of the Holocaust became apparent, Lemkin proposed at a conference in 1933 that the League of Nations should ban the crime of barbarity, which he defined as the premeditated destruction of national, racial, religious, and social collectives. The rise of the Nazi Party in Germany and deepening of anti-Semitism throughout Eastern Europe signaled that the topic was of more than academic interest. When the Wehrmacht stormed into Poland in 1939, Lemkin sought refuge first in Sweden and then in the United States. Deeply concerned about the fate of those now under German rule, he devoted himself to assembling the laws, orders, and decrees that chronicled Nazi policy toward Europe's occupied peoples, particularly its Jews. His massive 712-page study sought to document Nazi policy and introduced the term genocide into the English vocabulary. At Nuremberg and in various post-war trials, the Allies had charged and prosecuted German organizations and individuals with planning, initiating, and waging wars of aggression, conspiring to commit crimes against peace, committing war crimes, and committing crimes against humanity. Lemkin advised the U.S. chief counsel at the Nuremberg trials and continued the campaign for the international law criminalizing genocide. In December 1946, the General Assembly of the Young United Nations passed a resolution condemning and tasking a committee to draft an international treaty banning it. Committee members engaged with drafting the convention devoted much discussion and debate to defining genocide. What distinguished genocide from other forms of mass death, such as famine or war? How should the crime be defined so that the Soviets, guilty of their own mass murders, would not obstruct the treaty? And how could the treaty be made meaningful as a measure designed to stop the process of mass killing rather than simply punish those responsible after its completion? By 1948, the committee had completed its task. Articles 2 and 3 of the Convention on the Prevention and Punishment of the Crime of Genocide defined both the concept of genocide and what acts would be deemed punishable. Article 2. In the present convention, genocide means any of the following acts committed with the intent to destroy, in whole or in part, a national, ethnical, racial, or religious group, such as A. Killing members of the group. B. Causing serious bodily or mental harm to members of the group. C. Deliberately inflicting on the group conditions of life calculated to bring about its physical destruction in whole or in part. D. Imposing measures intended to prevent birth within the group. E. Forcibly transferring children of the group to another group. Article 3. The following acts shall be punishable. A. Genocide. B. Conspiracy to commit genocide. C. Direct and public incitement to commit genocide. D. Attempt to commit genocide. E. Complicity in genocide. The effectiveness of the Convention on the Prevention and Punishment of the Crime of Genocide has been limited. Adopted by a resolution of the General Assembly in December 1948, the Convention required ratification by 20 members of the United Nations before becoming into force. By October 1950, 20 states had ratified the Convention, but the United States was not amongst them. Initially, the American Bar Association and Southern senators opposed the treaty due to the ambiguities of Article 2. Later, conservatives opposed the convention due to the concerns about U.S. sovereignty. But its supporters never abandoned the issue, with Senator William Proxmire delivering some 3,211 speeches on the topic between 1967 and 1986. With President Ronald Reagan's strong support, the Senate finally ratified the convention in 1986, dragging its feet another 2 years before passing the Genocide Convention Implementation Act in October 1988. After exerting little influence for 40-odd years, the Convention on the Prevention and Punishment of the Crime of Genocide became an important reference point for tribunals, courts, and legal cases in the 1990s and 21st century. The International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia, the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda, the International Court of Justice, and International Criminal Court have all tried perpetrators of genocide, drawing upon the convention's definition of genocide. Yet Lemkin, Proxmire, and others had hoped that the convention would be an effective tool for preventing genocide, with Article 8 calling for the United Nations to take such action under the Charter of the United Nations as they considered appropriate for the prevention and suppression of the acts or any other acts enumerated in Article 3. Here, the record is less encouraging. During the Cold War, the international community made no effort to invoke the convention, while Mao Zedong's Great Leap Forward and Cultural Revolution killed millions of Chinese between 1958 and 1968. When Suharto's anti-communist campaign in Indonesia targeted entire villages for liquidation in 1965 to 1966, when Pakistanis' civil war veered toward genocidal mayhem in 1971, or when the Khmer Rouge eliminated an estimated 20% of the Cambodian population between 1975 and 1979. The U.S. accession to the convention in 1988 and at the end of the Cold War did not render the international community any more effective at stopping mass killings, with some 800,000 Tutsis slaughtered by Hutu extremists in Rwanda in April through July 1994, and with UN peacekeepers helplessly looking on the next year as Serb forces rounded up some 7,000 Bosnian men and boys for execution at Srebrenica. Indeed, during the Rwandan genocide, the State Department and National Security Council deliberately avoided using the term genocide precisely because they feared that the use of the term might compel some sort of action. This fear proved misplaced. In 1995, and 1999, NATO intervened to stop ethnic cleansing and war in Bosnia and Kosovo, subsequently stationing robust peacekeeping forces in the region. Sickened by the violence on NATO's doorstep and fearful that further inaction would undermine the alliance's credibility, European and American leaders responded out of both perceived national interest and humanitarian concerns without directly invoking the Genocide Convention. 10 years after the Rwandan genocide, the United Nations and the United States began to directly invoke the term as the killings in Darfur region of Sudan mounted. On the 7th of April 2004, UN Secretary General Kofi Annan announced an action plan to prevent genocide, subsequently appointing a special advisor on genocide prevention. Later that year, the U.S. Secretary of State, Colin Powell, specifically termed the crisis in Darfur a genocide. Yet only after protracted and difficult negotiations did the contours of an effective intervention force become apparent. In July 2007, UN Security Council Resolution UNSCR 1769 was unanimously adopted, authorizing a joint United Nations African Union UNAU peacekeeping force with a projected number of some 20,000 troops, more than 6,000 police, and a significant civilian component. 3 years had elapsed between Annan's action plan and the UN resolution. Despite rhetorical support for stopping genocide from the White House and the State Department, as of January 2008, UNAU mission in Darfur, UNAMID, the Joint African Union United Nations hybrid operation that replaced the African Union operation in Darfur, still lacks helicopters. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon remarked that, "In the past weeks and months, I have contracted personally every possible contributor of helicopters in the Americas, in Europe, in Asia, and yet not one helicopter has been made available yet." The Convention on the Prevention and Punishment of the Crime of Genocide clearly defines genocide and associated acts in Articles 1 and 2, and opens the door for contracting parties to call upon the competent organs of the United Nations to take such action under the Charter of the United Nations as they consider appropriate for the prevention and suppression of acts of genocide or any other acts enumerated in Articles 3. Yet, the treaty has been disappointing in its effect. For much of the Cold War, nations simply ignored the convention, and even during the post-Cold War era, simply been slow and reluctant to put speedy and effective intervention forces at the United Nations' disposal. Despite this, the treaty should not be dismissed as entirely ineffective. The special tribunals set up by the United Nations to try responsible parties for crimes of genocide, war crimes, and gross infractions of the international law may well exert a deterrent effect on groups.
Related concepts, democide and politicide. The concept of genocide is useful, communicating the intent to exterminate people for who they are rather than what they do. By using the term genocide, one conveys that people are being targeted because of their membership to a group rather than because of any particular action on their part. In war, enemy soldiers and combatants are targeted because of their contributions to the enemy's war effort. Theoretically, once soldiers have surrendered, or once combative civilians, those working in army factories, etc., cease contributing to their nation's war efforts, they become non-combatants and are no longer legitimate targets of war. In genocide, the targeted individual typically does not have this option. Turks targeted Armenians simply because they were Armenians. Nazis targeted Jews simply because they were Jews. The Hutus targeted the Tutsis because they were Tutsi. In framing the legal definition of genocide, those drafting the Genocide Convention restricted the concept of the group definition to national, ethnical, racial, or religious groups. Given that the Soviet would have blocked any measure that broadened the concept to include political and social groups, this was unavoidable at the time that the convention was framed in the 1940s. Thus, Stalinist killings, Indonesian massacres, and Mao's bloody repressions did not fall within the legal definition of genocide. Yet since the end of the Cold War, academics, journalists, politicians, and the general public have tended to use the term more broadly and include mass killings based on other forms of group identity. Comparative studies of genocide typically include the Stalinist extermination of the Kulaks, the Khmer Rouge elimination of intellectuals and the city dwellers, and Mao's mass killings. A number of authors have pushed the concept further to include political murder, such as Argentina's dirty war, and even strategic air campaigns that have targeted civilians. R.J. Rummel, a political scientist, has noted the discrepancy between the treaty definition of genocide, the expanded popular concept of the term, and related mass killings. He proposes that we adopt an alternative term, democide, Encompassing genocide, the killing of people by a government because of their indelible group membership. Politicide, the murder of any person or people by a government because of their political or political purposes. And mass murder, the indiscriminate killing of any person or people by a government. Rummel's influential Death by Government, 1994, and the statistics of genocide and mass murder since 1995 provide statistical examinations of each of these categories, arriving at a chilling conclusion that perhaps 262 million people died as a result of genocide in the 20th century. Rummel correctly argues that one should include politicide alongside genocide and assessing government-sanctioned mass murder. Yet, by arguing that civilians and prisoners of war killed by starvation, indiscriminate bombing and shelling and neglect during times of war are victims of mass murder rather than war, Rummel obscures the reality that war has always encompassed death beyond the battlefield, the sieges of antiquity, Genghis Khan's use of terror as a tool, British and German attempts to cut the flow of food to each other in both world wars, and the concept of nuclear deterrence all encompass death beyond the battlefield. Rummel's key findings, that totalitarian regimes engage in more democide behavior than democratic regimes, lends itself to misuse as a policy prescription. For Rummel, democide, war, and even famine have one simple solution, freedom. To foster freedom is to foster a solution to war and democide and to minimize domestic collective violence. Promoting democracy as a long-term strategy may decrease the frequency of war and democide, but the jury is still out on the subject. As a preventive and interventionist tool, stopping democide by the forcible overthrow of a regime has proven costly, ineffective, and diplomatically isolating. Addressing the goal of preventing and stopping genocide will prove difficult enough, but in contrast with the neoconservative agenda, that goal enjoys broad international support, with over 130 countries having publicly recognizing the stages and likelihood of genocide and mass killings. In order to prevent and stop genocide, one has to recognize its warning signs. This entails understanding the stages and steps toward genocide, assessing the likelihood of genocide, and then formulating preventive and interventionist responses. The Genocide Intervention Network, the USAMM, Committee on Conscience, Genocide Watch, Prevent Genocide International, and various other non-governmental organizations now issue specific alerts regarding potential and ongoing genocide, joining organizations with a broader mandate such as the International Red Cross, Amnesty International, and the Human Rights Watch. The Genocide Intervention Network and the USHMM Committee on Conscience do so by providing action alerts and listing areas of concern. Genocide Watch ranks crises as genocide emergencies when genocide is actually underway, genocide warnings when politicide or genocide is imminent, and genocide watches when early warning signs indicate the danger of mass killing or genocide. Concept of analyzing genocide structurally and identifying its stages owes much of its pioneering studies to the Holocaust. Raul Hilberts, The Destruction of the European Jews, has proven particularly influential. Halberg, like Lemkin, fled Nazi rule and settled in the United States. He attended Abraham Lincoln High School in Brooklyn and served in the U.S. Army and participated in the U.S. Army's war documentation, which assembled German records for use in post-war trials and for historical purposes. His Columbia dissertation, 1955, broke new ground by analyzing the structure and process of the final solution. Five publishers turned down the manuscript due to its length and subject matter. But since its initial publication in 1961, Heidelberg's work has become an essential, if controversial, reference point. The destruction of the European Jews provoked debate because it asserted that traditional Jewish strategies for dealing with force and persecution had failed disastrously during the 1930s and 1940s. Hilberg noted that many German policies, ranging from laws banning Jews from certain jobs to decrees assembling them into ghettos to requirements for distinct clothing, had historical precedents. He asserted that Jewish communities had over the centuries focused on alleviating the impact of discriminatory policies while generally complying with rather than confronting state policies. This tendency toward alleviation, evasion, paralysis, and compliance rather than resistance served Jewish communities well during the medieval and early modern period, but Hereberg claimed that it failed to recognize the contours of the process of genocide, and it is here that Hereberg has been most influential. His discussion of the structure of destruction laid a model for understanding how the Holocaust had been very different from the pogroms, massacres, and communal violence to which Jewish people had been long subjected. Hereberg concluded that the final solution involved a number of steps. First, the Nazi state had to define who was a Jew. This initial step proved more complicated than anticipated, in that Nazi racial ideology had abandoned religious definitions of Jews and Christians in favor of racial categories of Jew and Aryan. If laws banning Jewish employment and ownership were to be enforced, lawyers would have to clarify the status of children of mixed ancestry, determine whether exceptions should be made for Jewish veterans, and decide whether or not converted Jews should be subjected to these policies. Next, Jews found themselves the targets of expropriation, as Jewish firms were seized, as special taxes and levies were passed, and as family property and savings were confiscated. Expropriation led to concentration, as Jews were turned out of their houses, crowded into ghettos, and exploited as forced labor. Concentration, in turn, enabled more efficient annihilation, whether by mobile killing operations, by working Jews to death, or by industrialization process, gassing large groups and specially designed gas chambers. Hilbert's structural analysis of the destruction of Europe's Jews, laid out in Figure 1, has been adopted and dissembled widely, clearly laying out the stages and steps involved in the murder of some 6 million European Jews. Hereberg provided a structural analysis to which others have turned in seeking to understand other mass killings and genocides. Hereberg's model seeks to explain the stages that led to the Holocaust, a uniquely modern horror which prompted Lemkin to conceive the term genocide. Since its publication, the world has experienced additional mass killings, establishing the necessity for a broader, more general model for understanding genocide. Gregory Stanton, drawn to the field of genocide studies due to his early involvement in examining the Cambodian killing fields, has proposed the following schema, noting that prevention of genocide requires a structural understanding of the genocidal process. Stanton believes that genocide typically develops through 8 stages as described below. Classification. Distinguishing between different groups of people, establishing us and them categories. Symbolization. Identifying certain symbols with outgroups using either customary dress or government-imposed identifying symbols or distinctive clothing. Dehumanization. Associating targeted groups with repellent animals or microbes. Stanton gives the examples of Nazis calling Jews vermin, Rwandan Hutu hate ratio referring to Tutsis as cockroaches. Organization. Formation of groups and institutions ranging from mobs to militias to advanced bureaucracies that support and implement the genocide process. Polarization. The deliberate, systematic effort to cut social connections between targeted groups and the broader society. Stanton notes that the first to be killed in a genocide are moderates from the killing groups who oppose the extremists. Preparation. Stanton borrows from Hereberg, noting that preparation involves identifying those targeted, expropriating their property, concentrating the victims, and in most extreme cases, building facilities for extermination. Extermination. Killing the targeted outgroup. Denial. Stanton added an 8th stage, denial, to the process. He notes that typical records of the killings are burned, international accusations dismissed, and efforts are made to cover up the killings. As president of Genocide Watch, Stanton combines the attributes of activist, advocate, and scholar. His schema, fully developed on Genocide Watch's website, provides a conceptual model for understanding genocide, with Stanton providing examples of preventive measures that can be taken at each step. Barbara Haar, a political scientist at the U.S. Naval Academy, has added to our understanding of the genocide process by analyzing its causal factors using a comparative empirical approach. Haar has sought to identify key factors that should provide warning signs of possible genocide. The factors she identifies as contributing to its occurrence include 1. Prior incidents of genocide or politicide in the region. 2. A high degree of political upheaval. 3. A ruling elite defined in terms of ethnicity. 4. a belief system that justifies efforts to restrict, persecute, or eliminate certain categories of people. 5. An autocratic form of government, and 6. A trade system opposed to openness. Harp notes that her social scientific approach is not enough to tell us precisely when the genocidal violence is likely to begin, but she believes that an effort to systematically assess the risks of genocide improves the prospects for prevention and early response. Her work moves beyond Hilberg and Stanton's work of analyzing how genocide takes place and engages the question prevention and the responsibility to protect. Survivors, scholars, and activists have pushed our understanding of genocide and mass killings a good deal further than the legalistic definitions of the Genocide Convention. We now have well-researched models that explain mass killings as a process and identify the factors that contribute to its onset. Numerous organizations provide updates on global areas of concern, issuing watches, warnings, and emergency declarations. Yet despite this knowledge, it has become clear that information alone provides neither the impetus to intervene nor guidance on how to prevent or stop mass killings. A growing community of individuals, think tanks, and governments now advocate that the international community has the responsibility to protect R2P rather than focusing on specific terminology. Proponents of R2P argue that the international community has a responsibility to protect civilians when states fail to do so themselves, whether victims of genocide, ethnic cleansing, international famine, or indiscriminate war. Civilians subjected to mass killings have a right to protection, and when their governments and rulers fail to provide that basic right, then the international community has the responsibility and duty to do so. Secretary General Kofi Annan, who headed the United Nations Department of Peacekeeping Operations during the Rwandan genocide, appointed a panel in 2000 tasked with undertaking a thorough review of the United Nations peace and security activities and presenting a clear set of specific, concrete, and practical recommendations to assist the United Nations. Among its recommendations, the panel advised that the United Nations should develop its ability to fully deploy traditional peacekeeping operations within 30 days of the adoption of a Security Council resolution establishing such an operation, and within 90 days in the case of complex peacekeeping operations. Moreover, U.S. peacekeepers who witnessed violence against civilians were to presume that they were authorized to intervene. While the panel thereby recognized the responsibility of the U.N. peacekeepers to protect civilians from violence, it cautioned the United Nations does not wage war. Where enforcement actions is required, it has consistently been entrusted to coalitions of the willing state with the authorization of the Security Council, acting under Chapter 7 of the Charter. Given that genocide occurs most frequently during times of war, either because perpetrators use the cover of war to justify eliminating racial, religious, or political groups as part of a counterinsurgency, the UN model of Chapter 6 peacekeeping operations is inappropriate. Noting that Chapter 7 enforcement actions would fall to coalitions of the willing, the Canadian government established an International Commission on Intervention and State Sovereignty, ICISS, in September 2000. The Commission's report, issued in December 2001, has become the blueprint for the concept of R2P. Citing the experience and aftermath of Somalia, Rwanda, Srebrenica, and Kosovo, the ICISS asserted that when a particular state is clearly either unwilling or unable to fulfill its responsibility to protect or is itself the actual perpetrator of crimes or atrocities, the broader community of states has a responsibility to intervene. The Commission broke down the responsibility to protect into preventive, reactive, and rebuilding components, seeking to change the terms of the international debate on intervention from right to responsibility. The ICISS report has spurred numerous ongoing efforts that seek to explore how, when, by whom, and under what authorization protective interventions should take place. In the United States, the Henry L. Stimson Center in Washington, D.C. has a vibrant program exploring the future of peace operations. Harvard's Carr Center for Human Rights Policy and the U.S. Army's Peacekeeping and Stability Operations Institute are cooperating on the Mass Atrocity Response Operations Project, which seeks to develop credible and realistic operational planning for responding to genocide and mass atrocity. Most recently, the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum, the American Academy of Diplomacy, and the United States Institute of Peace convened a genocide prevention task force charged with issuing a report on genocide and intervention by December 2008. The concept of R2P is gathering momentum, shifting the focus of debate from legalities of genocide convention to the practicalities of prevention and intervention. R2P is ambitious, advocating that the community of states intervenes when one of its members fails to protect its own citizens, is the agent of ethnic cleansing, genocide, or the deliberate targeting of civilian populations in times of war. Preventing and stopping genocide, broadly defined, would be a first important step toward a world where mass murders cannot hide behind the veil of state sovereignty. One can take two approaches to devising strategies for preventing and stopping mass killings. One approach is to think in terms of generic scenarios and broad general strategies. This approach might be termed the doctrine approach, where generally accepted best practices are promulgated to be adapted as called by the specific situation. Another approach, most suitable when there are no generally accepted best practices, is the historical approach. Context-rich, the historical approach looks at specific scenarios, examines the historical record, and advances recommendations based on concrete case studies. The monograph takes the second approach, trusting that a full understanding of context and culture is required in devising strategies of prevention and intervention.